talk is entitled Applying Linguistics in the Conservation of the Social and Cultural Context of Underdocumented
Minorities. Hi, good morning. I am very pleased to be here, and I would like to appreciate you for coming to hear my presentation this morning about applying linguistics in the conservation of the social and cultural context of underdocumented languages. There are several points of continuity that I did not anticipate with the previous talk, so if you saw that talk, there's some interesting connections. But I do have kind of a lot of material to go over, so I'm gonna go quickly. I really like talking about this material, so if there's questions afterwards, I do welcome conversation about this material. So I'm gonna invite a little bit of participation from you on the first slide. So this is an Iroruto greeting. This is a language that I work on. So in the morning we tell each other, I would say to you, Munchenbire, which means good morning to you all. And then if you'd like to participate and say the next line, which is good morning to you. This is a common greeting and response between Iroruto people during the morning time. And the talk doesn't have an overabundance of language data, so I wanted to make sure that I gave you a little bit of Iroruto language to learn since we're talking about language conservation. So I would like to introduce the work in the following way. So language documentation, which I will abbreviate LD, of Iroruto language led me to a desire to develop a language conservation program for that language. However, I encountered a deficiency in how to integrate knowledge of applied linguistic concepts in a language conservation program for Iroruto. Secondly, I also, when thinking about applied linguistics as it pertains to language conservation, I was not actively considering it in the planning and process of carrying out language documentation with this language Iroruto. So I'm going to assert that these flaws reflect a general incongruence between language conservation and language documentation caused by a disparity between the types of activities that are concerned in the two fields, the audiences that they're generated for, and the level of scholarship in both fields rivals one another. And that is also a source of difficulty. So we have two fields to be comprehensively informed. So some background on Iroruto. This is an endangered language by most metrics. It has, in rough brackets, less than 10,000 speakers. There is also a decline of traditional transmission. And then to give a brief picture of where language documentation work with Iroruto is, there is audio video material which I've collected and I'm working to archive at Kaipuleohone at UH. The grammar I wrote for my dissertation. I'm working on a trilingual dictionary project so that it's useful to the community. Iroruto, the language located in Indonesia, so Indonesian and English. But I haven't worked on publishing anything about communicative competence, which will play a significant role in the talk. So a little bit more about background. The community provides a robust amount of support for language documentation and language conservation work. So this is fortunate, but it's also conditional in some regards. So there is a strong level of support, but for example, adults have expressed an interest to develop a school where youngsters can learn their heritage language. There's also several other offices, agencies, and groups to consider, such as the Statistics Office and language offices scattered through Indonesia. There is also university support of the nearest university, which is Universitas Negeri Indonesia Papua. That's the acronym UNIPA. The Manokwari, so in Manokwari, and that university also has a center for studying endangered languages. There's also possible external funding sources, which is important, because we want to make sure that there's backing for the projects. So the setting and the claim, to achieve fluidity, to remedy the difficulty of transitioning from language documentation to conservation, the interaction of four dimensions must be accounted for. So grammar, internal dynamics of social organization, psycholinguistic underpinnings, and language pedagogy. I would like to claim the central point of this presentation is that we must modify our view of language and doing linguistics if we are serious about addressing language endangerment and loss. An overview of the remainder of the talk. The second section proposes a view of language that is adequate for this purpose. The third section presents an argument in favor of using minority language teaching curricula that embrace traditional culture and interaction across social divisions within the culture. Fourth section is used to outline key points regarding bilingualism, especially in educational settings. And then I would like to present some tips and techniques that may be useful in designing or improving language documentation and language conservation work for my work, as well as other people that find them useful. So the final section concludes the presentation. So let us talk about two paradigms for language description. So a major hurdle for young documentationists, so this carries content over from the previous talk if you saw it, is to crack a new code, so the language that you're working with, using tools and terminology from a fairly unstandardized field, so this is language description. Various solutions have been proposed, such as Dixon's basic linguistic theory, but none has gained wide acceptance. This has been in existence since at least the 1980s, when Himes characterized two styles of studying language. One is nuts and bolts. Two examples are here, my own work and Nick Tieberger's description of South of Fate. And comparative generalization is the other paradigm, which is well represented by Phillips and Durante. Let's talk about nuts and bolts approach quick. So it has a long-standing tradition in the study of language, going back at least to Bois. It has a confidential aspect, so as linguists we tend to study things like phonology and morphology of syntax. Some places differentiate those from a larger heading of grammar. Theoretical assumptions and stance are always present, so here's a couple examples of types of theoretical stances. There's benefits and drawbacks of this approach. So one of the benefits, at least in working on Irarutu, that I found the most helpful was that when you study the phonology of a language, when you try to go in and explain to a government official what you're doing, they think, oh, this is really formal, it has nothing to do with social upheaval. So that's very helpful, especially in my work. It's a well-populated field of scholarship, so there's other people that work in these fields, phonology, grammar, and it also has a clear role in language documentation. However, there are drawbacks. It requires extensive training. Can get degrees in just this field. For example, studying phonology. It can be heavily dependent on a specific theory, as we know from studying things like phonology, and it tends to perpetuate the idea that language is separate from culture. This is, as I studied and as I was taught, this is like the worst thing you can say, is language and culture. We're also presented with a drawback for this approach, that it is challenging to use directly for language teaching, so we cannot give community members a grammar book and expect youngsters to figure out how to speak the language from it. By contrast, the comparative generalization approach, this is essentially the method of anthropology, the way that Himes presents it. There is a focus on communicative competence and, more recently, language socialization. It is strongly qualitative, but it also has quantitative aspect. So participant observation, interviewing, ethnography, narrative description. This is actually, there's a large number of components that could be put in here, but I limited it to these. And for quantitative work, there's the survey methodology, which is famous for, Labov is famous for his work in developing survey methodology. So there's also benefits and drawbacks, and if you'll notice, these are very similar to the nuts and bolts benefits and drawbacks. For example, it requires extensive analytical training. but I'll go over the benefits picked. So it reveals important sociocultural values and issues. So that's in complement to the nuts and bolts paradigm. It does facilitate language teaching because it provides a context, and it does contribute to ethnology. That's alluded to by the title of it, which is comparative generalization. So one drawback also, in addition to requiring extensive training, this continues also an idea from the previous talk, is that work takes a long time. So the previous presenter said that she spent 10 years working to get to a place where she felt she could start to make relevant decisions and progress. My work with Yoruba was about 8 years, so it takes a long time. Qualitative research also somehow treated as less persuasive than quantitative, especially for community members. Now, it is also challenging to use as the sole material in language teaching because it's not technical or does not contain enough diverse material. So is one approach better than the other? For our purposes, I'll say no. Language documentationists, however, would gain from adopting a hybrid approach of the two, that this will replicate the perspective of second language teaching. So we want to provide substantial data concerning things like phonology and grammar, including discourse material, and we want to also present sufficient description of communicative competence, so how to speak the language and to do culturally appropriate things through language. So let's talk a little bit about curriculum. Second language studies, this is applied linguistics, and language conservation. It is not uncommon to encounter examples where similar projects lead to conflicting conclusions. So the primary points of contention that I've noticed are how to treat languages in rapidly urbanizing settings, and what is the nature of the minority language teaching curriculum. So there was a talk by Alan King on Basque and Nahuatl at UH within the last year, and working with these two languages, he identified what he wanted to title falsehoods about language documentation and conservation, three of which I feel need to be reevaluated. For example, these are falsehoods about doing language documentation. So language recovery depends on learning from the elderly native speakers and teaching little children the language. The stronghold of our language is the countryside and the rural population, so that is where language recovery should be centered. And our language is the vehicle of an old traditional culture whose values and way of thinking must be tied to the survival of the language. So in contrast to King's perspective, Wilson, talking about Hawaiian language, points out that the degree of structural similarity and any cognancy between the minority language and the languages of its broader context must be taken into account when building a minority language teaching curriculum. So I'm going to compare English, Hawaiian, Iorutu, and Indonesian. Wilson works with English and Hawaiian, and I add Iorutu and Indonesian to look at very rapidly. Gender, kin terms, the first person, plural, pronoun, and possession. So insofar as gender, English pronouns he, she, and it require constant attention to gender categorization. The other three languages only have one singular third person pronoun, so downplays gender differentiation in categorization. Insofar as kin terms, English focuses on a nuclear family, father, mother, sister, brother. In Hawaiian, Iorutu, and English, we have a focus on extended family. There are specific terms going back 5 generations. So great, great, great grandfather. Interpretation of we have one term in English which places focus on the speaker and the self. In Iorutu, Hawaiian, and Indonesian, we have an inclusive-exclusive distinction which focuses on the other person, the addressees. So talking about possession, there's a small set of terminology and grammatical alternatives in English as well as Indonesian, and this is the place where English and Indonesian become similar, apart from being national languages. So it downplays the relationship, the possessive relationship, and how it came into being. Hawaiian and Iraruto, on the other hand, you must specify what the relationship and how it came to be. So, such as inalienability. The word for name in Iraruto is nu, and ja'nu fi Jason means my name is Jason. Name is something that is inalienable. So strategies for developing highly fluent young adult primary speakers, drawn from the Hawaiian case study. So instruction of that language was improved by including all of the phonemes in the language. So differentiating short and long vowels with the kahako and the glottal stop known as okina in Hawaiian language. Attention to traditional Hawaiian culture, so that's conserving the social and cultural context of this language, and using new teaching methods. As well, and this is really important also, I think, is connecting students with kupuna, so the elders and speakers from Ni'ihau. Some additional strategies are to use the language in daily life all day and as a peer group language. We need to teach the language through the language as the medium of instruction, excuse me. And it is important to note that there's a parallel with creolization that second language speakers can raise first language speakers of a language. So there's a disciplinary deficiency which I would like to address. So conflicting conclusions, such as we just saw, suggest the organization of uses of applied linguistics, not applied linguistics per se, but uses of it, could be improved by heightened awareness of the internal dynamics of social organization. For example, how people in a given culture are evaluated in and pass along traditional knowledge. So this is a crucial area for us as researchers to use critical investigation to not impose or superpose our own views and values on the group we study. I'm gonna pause a second and point out that one thing that studying linguistics doesn't teach you is how to react to a situation. In the previous talk, there was a comment about going into a community and listening versus going into a community like marching in and knowing all the answers already. There's no classes that we take that really teach us how to go in and sense what do we need to do here at this moment. And that's a crucial thing that makes us excel as researchers in linguistics, is if we can hone and heighten that skill. So there's a role for bilingualism in Iraruto language conservation. A primary goal of projects like mine is to promote and provide context where minority language speakers can flourish, such as distinctive schools and other indigenous language environments. But these contexts exist within the national structure of Indonesia. So Iraruto language conservation must therefore accommodate the role and grammar of Indonesian language in designing a curriculum and making a positive impact on community members' lives. So drawing a little bit more from the Wilson paper, it takes 7 years of intensive study to develop a high degree of fluency in a language. And these 3 points are specific to Hawaiian language, but they represent larger concepts and things that can be drawn to other contexts. So there needs to be support for after the primary schooling ends. There needs to be training for teachers of the language. And we also need to address the role of multiple languages functioning above the local microcosm level, which is the case especially where Iraruto is in West Papua. So there's also socio-cultural benefits of bilingualism, such as traveling abroad, which also reinforces language revitalization, if you're in that context. It allows one to examine issues from multiple perspectives. Primary speakers of minority official languages develop high proficiency in two languages. That's a really interesting and important point. It's easier to relate to and learn additional languages and cultures, and there's also potentially an economic asset. Talking about psycholinguistic aspects very fast, psycholinguistics is associated with language acquisition in contrast to language socialization. It's defined here by Groshin as the use of two languages in everyday life. So the quantity of input has a big role. There is also the ability for language to be sequential, and for a bilingual, for one to be more developed than the other, and for that relationship to change. Bilingualism influences development of important cognitive abilities, and this part I like also a lot in this research findings or presentation, is that when thinking about writing, bilingual writers seem to rely on their L1, the language that's more developed at a certain point, in its specific higher order strategies. So how do you construct discourse? Bilinguals interact differently with monolinguals and bilinguals. And you have the handouts, so I will leave you to look over some takeaways for using in bilingual education contexts. And I would like to say, in applying linguistics and language documentation and conservation, let the culture guide us in research into contexts where we can encounter traditional modes of transmitting knowledge. We need to give focus to activity-centered learning tasks and try to find and work with community members who can really enrich particular domains, especially in lexicon. And then we also need to gain general support from the population, and we also want to protect the domains where the language is spoken, the Honua, Olelo, Hawaii. And there also need to be ways to secure funding and also to have relationship with scholarship in the area. So we went over these sections talking about hybridized view of language, accommodating traditional knowledge and bilingualism, and how to apply linguistics and benefit from applied linguistics in language documentation and conservation endeavors. And that will cover it. Thank you very much. Please, if you don't have a handout, feel free to get one.
Can I have a question?
Oh, yes, please. You go.
So, in lots of endangered language situations, you know, parents are often thinking of their, you know, native language as disadvantaged and want to, you know, it's always they seem to assume that it is one or the other.
Yeah.
Right? And then so it's job to really enforce the, you know,
the value of the language.
The value of bilingualism, but how do you do it? You know, so as a linguist, we have evidence, we have, you know, how beneficial it is, and da 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 da. But how would you convince a, you know, Lutu parents who are thinking of, like, my kids want, you know, I want my kids to speak fluent Bahasa or English.
Yeah. So this context in West Papua, so this is a language from the island of New Guinea. If you're familiar with New Guinea, there's about a fifth of the diversity of languages in the world on this one island, yeah? So it's very, very diverse. So this is actually fortunate in this context, so I can't answer that question for all contexts. But here, it's really famous for people to know, in one of the towns where I worked, Bintuni, it's famous that there are 8 ethnic groups, each with their own language, plus Indonesian, so 9 languages going, and then everybody knows a little smattering of English. So it's actually kind of not hard to convince people that you should learn other languages. A lot of people already do, but it's the level of the youngsters that's really important to kind of provide them resources so that they can learn the language accurately. Because you're right, there is a big sense of, one of my consultants said he wanted to leave the countryside and get a good job in the city. And it took a lot of work for him to get enough money to get the airfare to get to the city. But once he got to the city, he admits, like, oh, my Indonesian isn't really that good because I'm an Irarutu speaker. But the kid's only speaking Indonesian. So it's in the city that it's kind of like we need to figure out a way to kind of arm and provide armor for these endangered languages so that when a youngster moves to the big city, they don't just forget their language and they have a community there. So this is where the distinctive schools would be really effective. In the countryside, there's no pressure from Indonesian. In the jungle, there's no pressure from Indonesian.
Find them. talked a lot about having these schools set up, I mean, probably from outside sources coming in, and, you know, trying to make them feel that it, you know, it's relevant to their culture, their history, but, I mean, is this something that they actively want, or is this something that as an L2er they look back on later and they wish they'd done it? I mean, is that what we're seeing where, I mean, they, it's retrospective or in hindsight?
Kind of close to that. So my little brother, my language consultant is my big brother, and then the next generation down, that's like the little brothers, yeah. And they're kind of aged to enter university. And when they hear the language, it's like really familiar. It's like when you go home, your house looks really familiar, yeah. It's really familiar for them, but they cannot answer the questions with like authority, yeah. And it's for them where they feel like, well, I speak Indonesian. And they don't really feel like, oh, I speak Irarutu too. But that's not really the case. If they were really forced in that situation, if everybody around them was Irarutu, that language would really start to flow easily. But they kind of don't have that context. And when you go to university, I was thinking about putting a picture of the Irarutu university students, and there's maybe like 18 or 20 of them. And that's like basically all of the Irarutus that are going to university right now. But for them in that context, they have it where they can talk to each other, and they're not experts in the language. They don't have that level of fluency. So they'll run out of like, a great example is how do you say door? And they come up with sanrimta, which means like house mouth. But there's actually a word, frufin, which means door, but they forget that, so they'll talk to each other and like, oh, how do you say the door? Oh, that's house mouth, yeah? Like, all right, so we'll say that's what it is, yeah? And it's those speakers that I really wanna bring in and get to use, bring them up to advanced primary speakers, even though it's kind of, they would still be bilingual at that point because they have such a good grasp of Indonesian. That's a great point. Thank you. Yes.
Something that I really quickly about bilingual speakers talk to each other differently than they do to monolingual speakers.
Oh yes, that's a finding from psycholinguistics in.
So can you clarify that for me? Whether it's good or bad or whatever.
I don't know if I can qualify it being good or bad, but what this is talking about is if I'm a bilingual speaker and I know you only speak English, I'm gonna talk and interact differently than I would with Pete maybe next door who also speaks Irarutu, for example. So I know I can draw on resources and make jokes and then also make things that are poignant, yeah, like, oh, this person is not in the same group, but we wanna include you, so we use the language, yeah, English, rather than use Irarutu or some other language, because it's probably like the good and the bad part about that is you can exclude people or include people through your language choice. And if I know I can include him and exclude you, like that's one of the ways that we would interact differently, yeah? But it's a really neat kind of thing to think about, yeah? Because all of the different dynamics. So in the area where I was, Irarutu is located, those eight languages, people are like picking and choosing like, oh, I can speak Chinese here, Japanese here, Irarutu there, Spanish over there. So you can draw the network tighter, but then it also can fall apart too, yeah? Of, oh, we don't get along with those people, so we're not gonna like talk to them, yeah? They came and raided us last year, so we're still angry at them. This is an area where they still have tribal conflict, yeah? Like periodically they'll go in battlefield and just slay each other for a while, so. It's a little tricky, so you may not actually speak with somebody that you could speak with because you have the ability, but because of other reasons, you may not, yeah.
Well,
thank you also.